It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mont Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Welcome back to Alaska Tracks. I'm your host, Randy Zarnke. This program utilizes excerpts from interviews I've recorded with veteran outdoorsmen, people like bush pilots and trappers and hunters and biologists. They share stories from their lives in the great Alaskan outdoors. Today's featured guest is Jake Phillips of Pelican. We started the interview with Jake last week, but have plenty of material to fill up today's episode as well. In this first segment, Jake talks about bears and goats and his fishing career. Let's get started.
Well, how about bears? All this time you've been out, I'm sure you've had a bear incident or two.
Yeah, well, I started out being pretty much afraid of bears. My cousin, when he was 17 years old, he was chewed up in Slocum Arm off the boat. It was a deckhand on the boat. It was with his dad. And I remember hauling him into Chichikov. I was just a kid, and he was all tore up there. He had bad bites. I had nightmares over that. So I was spooky about bears for a long time. It seemed like I went to great lengths to stay away from them. You know, I didn't want nothing to do with the damn things. I was not interested in shooting a bear or even be around them. But people shot them, and then eventually a friend of mine and I was out, and we were goat hunting. I must have been 30 years old at the time. We were up there in one of these trails in this goat area, and in the mountains behind Sitka, there in Bear Mountain, and we were in an area there that was no way but past us, and here comes this bear ambling along this trail. And the closer he got to us, it seemed like the more he was after us. Still to this day, I think he figured we were brown goats or something, and he was after a meal, because he was huffing and puffing, and he wasn't snapping his jaws or anything, but he was just making lots of racket. And this friend of mine named Pete Miller, he says, "I'm going to shoot that guy." He says, "I'm going to let him get no closer." I don't remember what kind of gun Pete had, but I had a .348 carbine, model 71 at the time, and I used 200 grain bullets. And so go ahead. I've been with guys that have shot bear before, but I always took a back seat. Anyhow, this bear came a little closer. I think Pete got excited or something. I think he missed. And he said later, he's hand loaded, and he said, "I don't think my shells were working." And the bear still kept coming, and he was probably 150 feet away, not too far. And he stopped. And then he started sniffing around. I had a good opportunity, so I nailed him. And I got him right smack in the neck. Perfect. He tumbled over and over and over and went on down the hill. And we went and took a look at him. And he wasn't all that big a bear, 300-400 pounds, something like that. But that was my first bear.
So did you get over being afraid of him?
Well, I'm not sure. No, I got a healthy fear. I got a healthy respect for them guys. We've had them right here in the yard, and I've gone out on a porch, and my grandson live over next door over there. They had a king salmon hanging in the smokehouse one day, and my daughter-in-law, Maura, called, and she said, "I think a bear's going to get Jeb's fish." And I said, "Well, not if I can help it." So I took my short barrel shotgun that I keep full of sabots here, and I had bear spray. And I had that little jitney I got. So I drove right over there, and in the meantime, the bear was down on the bushes. And I just got up on a porch with her, and we watched the bear, and it was just in the salmonberry bushes. Pretty soon, the dog noticed the bear was there, started to bark. And then that alerted the bear, and then he started kind of wondering what was going on around, but I think he could smell that salmon hanging in that little smokehouse over there. And he started kind of going that direction. Well, then I never noticed this before, but that little dog we had nipped the heel of that bear, and so the bear couldn't concentrate on me because I was walking over that way with my shotgun, and I had a bear spray, and what I was going to try was this to see if it worked, but I couldn't get close enough to it, darn thing. And that little dog would nip it, and then it'd jump back, and the bear would turn around to face the dog, and they had me on one side and the dog on the other, and so we herded him clean on by the smokehouse, and pretty soon he wandered off up into the woods, and we let him go, and I never got a chance to try my bear spray or anything, but that was the first time that I ever actually walked up to a bear and drove it away, if the dog helped me. But I've seen lots of them. They've always managed to leave. I've never had one give me any problems otherwise.
Do you remember any particularly large bears that you encountered?
Well, yeah, I do. And I think the bear was shot later by one of Paul Johnson's clients. He's a hunter that hangs around Gull Cove around the corner here. He's actually out of Juneau. The bear was about 29 years old, real old for a bear. He told me the skull measurement. It was within an inch or so of a record. I don't remember how big. I saw that guy, and I saw where he had bitten a tree. Now I use a Savage 30-06 Model 110. It's a nice light gun. I could hold that gun up there, and it's kind of standing on my tiptoes on a little rock that was right. I could touch where that fellow was biting that tree. I don't want to be even close to that. My brother-in-law both saw him on a beach, and his stomach just dragged the ground. He was a big man. Well, you couldn't even see his ears. It was so big in the head, and his face was kind of hanging down. And, you know, you could just tell he's a big old bear. I have no idea how big he was, but Paul said that they shot him right there where we'd seen him, and they got him in the evening. It was the guy's last chance to get a bear. It was an out-of-state client, and it was a lucky shot, and he dropped where he was, and I think Paul said he's one of the biggest bears he's ever seen, too. Yeah. So, yeah, I've seen big ones.
How about goats? You mentioned goat hunting a little bit.
Well, I hunted goats four times, and the fourth time I got lucky. My partner and I, a guy by the name of Barton Sollers, flew into a lake with this Afton coon that I mentioned. It was a pilot in those days, and there was a little lake up between Cat Leanne and Kelp Bay. Flew us into that lake, and we got a goat apiece, and we camped overnight, and we flew out of there, and everything was perfect. After I got through eating 140 or 50 pounds of goat meat, I never wanted to see another one in my lifetime. And that's the end of that, you know.
Not the best tasting meat?
Well, not compared to these black-tailed deer. I couldn't give it away, put it that way.
Fishing has come up a couple of different times, and it was an important part of your life. Tell us a little bit about your fishing career.
Yeah, well, it spanned 50 years or more. I started out as a kid, telling this old story. There used to be an old-timer here that called himself a son of the beach, and I am. I started out that way. I can remember growing up being just a shaver. I'd hang out with these old-timers, old, crusty, old reprobates that most people wouldn't dream of letting their kids, but I never was mistreated, never. In fact, I can remember one old duffer wanted to make sure I took a shower and cleaned up before I went home because my mom would kill him if I come home dirty. My whole career, I'm doing just exactly what I wanted to do. I've commercial fished to make a living. I was in a logging camp. I worked construction. I worked as a carpenter. I did quite a few jobs. I worked in a grocery store. I worked in a fish cannery. But there's nothing like running a commercial fishing boat that you go out and you make a living at it if you can. If you don't, well, you got to do something else to pay the bills. You learn the hard way. And I started out, obviously, being a troller, fishing king salmon. And then I graduated to being crew on a longline boat, fishing halibut. Then later on was black cod. And luckily, I learned that black cod game as a crew member, because by the time I got a boat big enough to have my own crew and fish halibut and black cod, then they became worth something. So I was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time through all this, and I wound up with licenses and IFQs and things like that, and so I'm able to retire from the general fishing career, although I still go. Like I say, my sons are involved in it, my grandsons are involved in it, and once in a while there's a need for me to go, but I really appreciate being able to spend the rest of my life on the beach here, my place here, and I do what I damn well please. But yes, I did make a living fishing. I've never had to turn my back on it and go anywhere else in my career anyhow. It's been hard, but you have to be a little bit frugal. In my time, there was no going to Mexico in the wintertime, and none of that flying over to Hawaii or any of that stuff. But I feel I don't have to go anywhere. I got everything I need here in Alaska. Why would I want to go anywhere?
What a great attitude. I mean, if you've got everything you want right here.
Got everything I want right here. My father came from Washington State, and my mother came from California. And he was a beach bum. We were riding a motorcycle. They migrated to Alaska in 1929. I think he got stuck up here on a fishing boat and he didn't make any money and he had to stay and sent for my mother and she came up here and none of us ever left. They died here and I will too.
Well, you must have seen the real ups and downs of the commercial fishing industry, prices and fish stocks going up and down. Can you share a little bit of your insight there?
Yeah, I was involved in fish politics a lot, too. I guess there's some disappointments I have in my life that I think we could have done much better than we have, that I don't quite know how to go about it. I don't quite know how to tell anybody, but I just kind of sit quiet now, and it seems like it kind of we have recovered the same old ground every once in a while. The American public, well, they're the consumer, and we have to do a good job for them. We can't have half-ass programs, and it's not going to work. These people are too smart. Man, we can cover a million tapes, but it just, yes, commercial fishing is up and down, but how much it's manipulated by us, how much is manipulated by the processors or the buyers, how much is manipulated by the government itself that possibly isn't doing the right job, and I don't know that. I keep thinking we're on the right track. I was a real advocate for, we've got to call them hatcheries, but they're not hatcheries. It's the programs that's going on in northern and southern southeast, Cook Inlet, Prince William Sound. What they are is helping out Mother Nature a little bit in certain places. I think we get off track a little bit in some of these programs, but we've got good people working there, and well, I think Mother Nature does need a hand some places, but we've got to be real careful. And as far as our wild stocks are concerned here in southeastern, you know, we're going to take a hit one of these days. Mother Nature's got a way of throwing a curve, and we've been pretty damn lucky. And one of these days we're going to get it. And we don't know when or what. It seems to me that in this commercial fishing business, I always go back to the halibut. Whether they're more hardy than salmon or whether they're apt to be less to be mismanaged or what, but I really think that the International Halibut Commission has probably done the best all-around job of managing a species of fish than anybody. And it's two governments, it's Canada and the United States. And they formed that in the late 20s, early 30s because the stocks were down. And we've had stocks go up and down for various reasons since. But that type of management, it seems to me, can be followed by other species managers. But it's just not happening. And why, I don't know. Because it is a success story for over 100 years. And right now we've got halibut up a yin-yang, and they keep coming. And we've got a good program, and it's all proven fact. That's my disappointment, that we're not following known, proven ways of doing things, whether it's managing our fur or managing a seal harvest or managing the halibut or salmon. I really think that the state, since statehood, has probably done a pretty damn fair job, but we got to keep the politics out of it. It's strictly management of a resource. Man, when there's a success story, that's the way we should be going.
When listening to Jake, you can readily sense the depth of knowledge he has earned over the years. Time for us to take a break and hear from the sponsors of our program. Next time you visit one of our sponsors, please thank them for sponsoring this program. Now let's get back to our interview with Jake Phillips of Pelican.
Well, in all your years, you must have run into some bad weather when you were out fishing.
Oh, we got it. Well, there was lots of bad ones, and I was scared plenty. When I was fishing a small boat alone, I never got myself scared because there was nobody but me to worry about. But when I had a crew on my boat, and then sometimes I had my wife, and then later on I had my sons, and some of my sons' friends, these young kids of friends of mine, then you have all this responsibility. Well, the worst, obviously, was this fairweather ground that sits right out here. It's about 80 miles from us. It's a treacherous place. There's a lot of tide. But, man, we made a living out there. That was a bed for trolling salmon, fishing halibut, fishing blackcod, and it still is. Nowadays, the government has got such a great system. The weather reports, if I turn on that radio, I can tell you exactly what it is in a fairweather buoy right now. We didn't have anything like that when I started out here. And the boats were smaller and the communications were almost nothing. And we used to get caught. I could say some words about it, but if you think about that picture of Jesus at the wheel steering and the weather's bad, and boy, I thought about that quite a few different nights, trying to get my boat and my crew or my family back to safety. And There's no specific storm, but when a bad one comes, it's bad. But there's also some beautiful times. When the sun comes up in the morning and you're 70 miles offshore there and you have a fair weather range, it's beautiful. You can't beat that. It only takes one day like that to counter out all them bad weather days. And then, of course, there's those evenings when you're loaded with fish, you're catching king salmon so fast you can't dress them, and you're out there and there's no one else around, and that makes it worthwhile. The world is good, you're going to get a good price, everybody's healthy and happy, cancels out all that bad stuff.
Well, I know a lot of fishermen have real attraction to certain boats, good memories. Do you have anything in particular that you want to say about any of your boats?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The boat I got now, the Leah, the one you're on, it's a Canadian-style troller. It's built in the Columbia River by Canadians. And I like that boat. I've had it for 17 years now. Prior to that, I had a boat called a Nancy K. And then the love of my life, the one before that, I had for 11 years. And that boat was named Aloha, and it was built in Seattle. It was a typical Ballard halibut boat. It was built by Sagsted, and a wonderful sea boat. But just the fact that we were growing out of it, we needed a little bit bigger one, and my wife saw the galley arrangements on the next boat, and she just said, if you expect me to cook any more for you, you better buy this one. So I did. And that Aloha went to another guy, and it went through two, three different people, and it was finally lost off of Sitka. But that boat has a special spot, because we probably went through every kind of weather imaginable, from California, we went tuna fishing, to Kodiak, we went halibut fishing. And it was only 56 feet, old style, narrow, long, but it's a wonderful sea boat. And I caught a lot of fish with that boat, lots of fish. Broke in my sons and broke in lots of other young guys. One guy I broke in on that boat went on to be captain of the America Number One, which is the number one American fish dragger up in the Bering Sea. He was part owner and really exceptional fisherman in his own right. Well, he broke in with me on the Aloha as a young kid. I got him out of Friday Harbor, Washington, and his name was Perovich. And he tried and tried and tried to get a job on a Seattle halibut boat, but they wouldn't hire him because his name was Perovich. He said he thought he'd change his name to Olson or something like that. They'd have hired him for sure. I hired him. He's probably one of the best fishermen that I've ever been around in my life. From there, I got him a job on a schooner with a Seattle boat. When he went from there and he fished with other guys. But anyhow, I'll go back to the Aloha. That was the heart and soul of our operation at one time, and everything goes to that. Before that, didn't really count that much. After that, it was anticlimax.
Well, how about cabins? Some people have cabins scattered around the countryside. Will they use? Do you ever build any cabins?
Yes, we tried. But the United States Forest Service here in southeastern Alaska had a real problem with any of us out there erecting shelters. I don't have anything against Forest Service. I got some fine friends. I want to get that straight, because I sat in a bar right here in Pelican with one of the head rangers in the district, and he said, I understand what you're saying, but he says, supposing that all this land was private owned, he said, then where would you go? And I said, well, that's true. I guess I have to think about that too. So they were caught in between. Are they going to either have public land or we're going to have private land? But I thought that they ought to grant exceptions with people like trappers that are only going to be out in the woods a certain. And I guess later on they did. But anyhow, the experience that we had is they'd follow us around and chase us out. So it got to be to hell with it. And it was easy here. We had a fishing boat anyhow, so we just had our equipment aboard. But there's times when we wish we were parked on land someplace and stormy weather and ice condition. But we got by, and I didn't hold any grudges to anybody. The Forest Service went around and burned all the shelters that was here to begin with. I mean, all the old mining camps and everything is along the beach. They saw fit to burn them all down. I don't know why they did it. They could never answer that, because I know people that saved their lives to some of these old shelters that were out here on the coast. But They burn them down anyhow, and don't allow anybody to build anything, especially in this wilderness area along here in the outside coast. So it was a kind of a prickly situation. We were out there trapping in a wilderness area, and we were perfectly legal to trap there. Everything was fine, and I was one of the ones that agreed with having a wilderness area because I know you have to have some. But I wanted full use, you know. And there's groups that still push to get what they want out of it. Some of it's necessary and some isn't. No, we didn't go for shelters. We created our own and moved them with us, you might say that.
Well, you touched on it a little bit with the Forest Service. How about anybody at Fish and Game that you might have interacted with, game wardens or fish cops or biologists that you want to comment on?
Oh, them guys are the best as far as I'm concerned. Commercial fishing industry is some of my best friends who work for Fish and Game, and the same with the game division. Board members, and I never was on a fish board, but I attended a lot of meetings, a game board and a fish board. I got real good friends and good relationship with lots of those people. But just the Forest Service ranger, too, that was a little bit pushy, and I figured they should send them somewhere else than here. But not all of them. There's lots of good guys there, too. And the game wardens, heck, I know one guy was after me, and that's the only criminal offense that I've ever had in my life. That's the trapping out of season. And he caught me, and he caught me fair and square. I didn't try to get out of it. And his name was Helsinger, the old tough Gomer Helsinger. I think he was Petersburg. I don't know where he went, but he was a warden in Sitka for a long time. And then we had fish and wildlife guys there too, federal guys. And one of my friends there used to be a fisherman, and he was there, game warden, I guess that was Bob LaGuire. Well, he was there for years, and he retired there, he's still in Sitka. And I see him every time we get together, we visit. I consider him a friend of mine. And so, yeah, it was good relationships with fish and game people over the years. But they still continue. I make sure I know who the people in the office, and I make sure we go discuss things, and no problem.
How about flying? Did you ever own any airplanes or do any flying?
Yeah, I did a lot of flying, but we didn't fly in to hunt or trap very much. We usually families, and you know, there again, we couldn't afford a lot of those things, even though when I first moved to Pelican over here from Sitka, it only cost $25 to charter over here. But no, I didn't do much flying around. It's an easy way to do it. I probably missed a lot of things, but I was always pretty easy to satisfy. And look at that, what we got there.
Looking at the scenery across the bay.
You're looking down that way. I don't know how well you can see, but you see those mountains there? That's Jacoby Island there. And then this is north end of Chichagof Island. Jacoby Island is a pretty good-sized chunk of real estate itself. And it's everything you want to do there, from cutthroat trout to sockeye subsistence fish to hunt deer and bears and trap, and there's marten all over the thing. And that's just a little island in the north end of the panhandle here. But then this is Chichagof Island, and you know how big that is. Do everything I want right here. There's been mountains I haven't been on and lakes that I've never fished in. So that would be nice to be able to fly into some of those outlying places. And I'd thought about it, and I have friends that do it, but I just never got around to it. Time's run out. Now I'm content to putter around on a beach here. And I had a nice spike buckwalk right up there last fall. When I'm hunting season, I try to keep my gun right here handy. And if I let him walk over there, you know, I might have got a chance. You heard me talking to that one guy there in Pelican on the boardwalk. He said that Sitka's crazy with tourists and charter boaters and all that stuff. And it is. That's why I'm here now. It'll get busier here. There'll be a lot more fishermen come and go in here.
But you like the pace of life here better than...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's just old-time Alaska here. Suits me to a T.
Well, is there anything else that you can think of that we haven't covered that you'd like to talk about?
I've lived too long being under the influence of people that are just a little bit too prone to lock things up. And I kind of think that we've got to expand our horizons a little bit. I think we've got to look at that side of things here for a while. And if we do something wrong, we can undo it again. But we have to give the other side a chance and see what we can do with Alaska and its natural resources. I think that we can do some things and do it right. In fact, I think we proved that we can do things right. You know, we just have to be allowed to do it.
In this next segment, Jake talks about weather conditions during his commercial fishing career and his favorite boats that he owned over the years. He wraps up with comments about management of fish and game animals and fur bearers.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.